Prime Day is coming July 16th and 17th, with epic deals exclusively for Prime members. You'll feel like you just won an award.
Oh, wow, I didn't even prepare a speech. I'd like to thank my family for always needing stuff. Also, Sam, my delivery guy, for bringing all my awesome deals so fast. You're the man, Sam!
Shop deals on electronics, home, and more this Prime Day, July 16th and 17th.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at cenovus.com.
Chapter 8 of G.K. Chesterton's Charles Dickens. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. The Time of Transition. Dickens was back in London by June of 1845. About this time, he became the first editor of the Daily News, a paper which he had largely planned and suggested, in which I trust remembers its semi-divine origin. That is, his thought had been running, as suggested in the last chapter, somewhat monotonously on his Christmas domesticities, is again suggested by the rather singular fact that he originally wished the Daily News to be called The Cricket. Probably he was haunted again with his old vision of a homely, tale-telling periodical, such as had broken off in Master Humphrey's Clock. About this time, however, he was peculiarly unsettled. Almost as soon as he had taken the editorship, he threw it up, and having only recently come back to England, he soon made up his mind to go back to the Continent. In the May of 1846, he ran over to Switzerland and tried to write Dombey and Son at Lausanne. Tried to, I say, because his letters are full of an angry impotence. He could not get on. He attributed this especially to his love of London and his loss of it. The absence of streets and numbers of figures. My figures seem disposed to stagnate without crowds about them. But he also, with shrewdness, attributed it more generally to the laxer and more wandering life he had led for the last 2 years. The American tour, the Italian tour, diversified, generally speaking, only with slight literary productions. His ways were never punctual or healthy, but they were also never unconscientious as far as work was concerned. If he walked all night, he could write all day. But in this strange exile, or interregnum, he did not seem able to fall into any habits, even bad habits. A restlessness beyond all his experience had fallen for a season upon the most restless of the children of men. It may be a mere coincidence, but this break in his life very nearly coincided with the important break in his art. Dombey and Son, planned in all probability some time before, was destined to be the last of a quite definite series, the early novels of Dickens. The difference between the books from the beginning up to Dombey and the books from David Copperfield to the end may be hard to state dogmatically, but it is evident to everyone with any literary sense. Very coarsely, the case may be put by saying that he diminished, in the story as a whole, the practice of pure caricature. Still more coarsely, it may be put in the phrase that he began to practice realism. If we take Mr. Stiggins, say, as a clergyman depicted at the beginning of his literary career, and Mr. Crisparkle, say, as a clergyman depicted at the end of it, it is evident that the difference does not merely consist in the fact that the first is a less desirable clergyman than the second. It consists in the nature of our desire for either of them. The glory of Mr. Crisparkle partly consists in the fact that he might really exist anywhere in any country town into which we may happen to stray. The glory of Mr. Stiggins wholly consists in the fact that he could not possibly exist anywhere except in the head of Dickens. Dickens has the secret recipe of that divine dish. In some sense, therefore, when we say that he became less of a caricaturist, we mean that he became less of a creator. That original violent vision of all things which he had seen from his boyhood began to be mixed with other men's milder visions and with the light of common day. He began to understand and practice other than his own mad merits, began to have some movement toward the merits of other writers, toward the mixed emotion of Thackeray or the solidity of George Eliot. And this must be said for the process, that the fierce wine of Dickens could endure some dilution. On the whole, perhaps his primal personalism was all the better when surging against some saner restraints. Perhaps a flavor of strong Stiggins goes a long way. Perhaps the colossal Crumless might be cut down into 6 or 7 quite creditable characters. For my own part, for reasons which I shall afterwards mention, I am in real doubt about the advantage of this realistic education of Dickens. I am not sure that it made his books better, but I am sure it made them less bad. He made fewer mistakes, undoubtedly. He succeeded in eliminating much of the mere rant or cant of his first books. He threw away much of the old padding, all the more annoying, perhaps, in a literary sense, because he did not mean it for padding, but for essential eloquence. But he did not produce anything actually better than Mr. Chuckster. But then there is nothing better than Mr. Chuckster. Certain works of art, such as The Venus of Milo, exhaust our aspiration. Upon the whole, this may perhaps be safely said of the transition. Those who have any doubt about Dickens can have no doubt of the superiority of the later books. Beyond question, they have less of what annoys us in Dickens, but do not, if you are in the company of any ardent adorers of Dickens, as I hope for your sake you are, do not insist too urgently and exclusively on the splendor of Dickens' last works, or they will discover that you do not like him. Dombey and Son is the last novel in the first manner. David Copperfield is the first novel in the last. The increase in care and realism in the second of the two is almost startling. Yet even in Dombey and Son we can see the coming of a change, however faint, if we compare it with his first fantasies, such as Nicholas Nickleby or The Old Curiosity Shop. The central story is still melodrama, but it is much more tactful and effective melodrama. Melodrama is a form of art, legitimate like any other, as noble as farce, almost as noble as pantomime. The essence of melodrama is that it appeals to the moral sense in a highly simplified state, just as farce appeals to the sense of humor in a highly simplified state. Farce creates people who are so intellectually simple as to hide in packing cases or pretend to be their own aunts. Melodrama creates people so morally simple as to kill their enemies in Oxford Street and repent on seeing their mother's photograph. The object of the simplification in farce and melodrama is the same, and quite artistically legitimate, the object of gaining a resounding rapidity of action which subtleties would obstruct. And this can be done well or ill. The simplified villain can be spirited charcoal sketch or a mere black smudge. Carker is a spirited charcoal sketch, Ralph Nickleby a mere black smudge. The tragedy of Edith Dombey teems with unlikelihood, but it teems with life. That Dombey should give his own wife censure through his own business manager is impossible. I will not say in a gentleman, but in a person of ordinary sane self-conceit. But once having got the inconceivable trio before the footlights, Dickens gives us good ringing dialogue very different from the mere rants in which Ralph Nickleby figures in the unimaginable character of a rhetorical moneylender. And there is another point of technical improvement in this book over such books as Nicholas Nickleby. It is not only a basic idea, but a good basic idea. There is a real artistic opportunity in the conception of a solemn and selfish man of affairs feeling for his male heir, his first and last emotion mingled of a thin flame of tenderness and a strong flame of pride. But with all these possibilities, the serious episode of the Dombeys serves ultimately only to show how unfitted Dickens was for such things, how fitted he was for something opposite. The incurable poetic character, the hopelessly non-realistic character of Dickens' essential genius, could not have a better example than the story of the Dombeys. For the story itself is probable. It is the treatment that makes it unreal. In attempting to paint the dark pagan devotion of the father as distant from the ecstatic and Christian devotion of the mother, Dickens was painting something that was really there. This is no wild theme like the wanderings of Nell's grandfather or the marriage of Gride. A man of Dombey's type would love his son as he loves Paul. He would neglect his daughter as he neglects Florence, and yet we feel the utter unreality of it all, the utter reality of monsters like Stiggins or Mantalini. Dickens could only work in his own way, and that way was the wild way. We may almost say this, that he could only make his characters probable if he was allowed to make them impossible. Give him license to say and do anything, that he could create beings as vivid as our own aunts and uncles. Keep him to likelihood, and he could not tell the plainest tale so as to make it seem likely. The story of Pickwick is credible, though it is not possible. The story of Florence Dombey is incredible, although it is true. An excellent example can be found in the same story. Major Bagstock is a grotesque, and yet he contains touch after touch of Dickens' quiet and sane observation of things as they are. He was always most accurate when he was most fantastic. Dombey and Florence are perfectly reasonable, but we simply know that they do not exist. The Major is mountainously exaggerated, but we all feel that we have met him at Brighton. Nor is the rationale of the paradox difficult to see. Dickens exaggerated when he had found a real truth to exaggerate. It is a deadly error, an error at the back of much of the false placidity of our politics, to suppose that lies are told with excess and luxuriance, and truths told with modesty and restraint. Some of the most frantic lies on the face of life are told with modesty and restraint, for the simple reason that only modesty and restraint will save them. Many official declarations are just as dignified as Mr. Dombey, because they are just as fictitious. On the other hand, the man who has found a truth dances about like a boy who has found a shilling. He breaks into extravagances as the Christian churches broke into gargoyles. In one sense, truth alone can be exaggerated. Nothing else can stand the strain. The outrageous Bagstock is a glowing and glaring exaggeration of a thing we have all seen in life, the worst and most dangerous of all its hypocrisies. For the worst and most dangerous hypocrite is not he who affects unpopular virtue, but he who affects popular vice. The jolly fellow of the saloon bar and the race course is the real deceiver of mankind. He is misled more than any false prophet, and his victims cry to him out of hell. The excellence of the Bagstock conception can best be seen if we compare it with the much weaker and more improbable knavery of Pecksniff. It would not be worth a man's while, with any worldly object, to pretend to be a holy and high-minded architect. The world does not admire holy and high-minded architects. The world does admire rough and tough old army men who swear at waiters and wink at women. Major Bagstock is simply the perfect prophecy of that decadent jingoism which corrupted England of late years. England has been duped, not by the cant of goodness, but by the cant of badness. It has been fascinated by a quite fictitious cynicism, and reached that last and strangest of all impostures in which the mask is as repulsive as the face. Dombey and Son provides us with yet another instance of this general fact in Dickens. He could only get to the most solemn emotions adequately if he got to them through the grotesque. He could only, so to speak, really get into the inner chamber by coming down the chimney. Like his own most lovable lunatic in Nicholas Nickleby, a good example is such a character as Toots. Toots is what none of Dickens' dignified characters are, in the most serious sense, a true lover. He is the twin of Romeo. He has a passion, humility, self-knowledge, a mind lifted into all magnanimous thoughts, everything that goes with the best kind of romantic love. His excellence in the art of love can only be expressed by the somewhat violent expression that he is as good a lover as Walter Gay is a bad one. Florence surely deserved her father's scorn if she could prefer Gay to Toots. It is neither a joke nor any kind of exaggeration to say that in the vacillation of Toots, Dickens not only came nearer to the psychology of true love than he ever came anywhere else, but nearer than anyone else ever came. To ask for the loved one, and then not to dare cross the threshold, to be invited by her, to long to accept and then to lie in order to decline, these are the funny things that Mr. Toots did, and that every honest man who yells with laughter at him has done also. For the moment, however, I can only mention this matter as a pendant case, to be the case of Major Bagstock, an example of the way in which Dickens had to be ridiculous in order to begin to be true. His characters that begin solemn and futile, his characters that begin frivolous and solemn in the best sense, his foolish figures are not only more entertaining than his serious figures, they are also much more serious. The Marchioness is not only much more laughable than Little Nell, she is also much more of all that Little Nell was meant to be, much more really devoted, pathetic, and brave. Dick Swiveller is not only a much funnier fellow than Kit, he is also a much more genuine fellow, being free from that slight strain of meekness or the snobbishness of the respectable poor which the wise and perfect Chuckster wisely and perfectly perceived in Kit. Susan Nipper is not only more of a comic character than Florence, she is more of a heroine than Florence any day of the week. In Our Mutual Friend, we do not, for some reason or another, feel really very much excited about the fall or rescue of Lizzie Hexham. She seems too romantic to be really pathetic, but we do feel excited about the rescue of Miss Podsnap, because she is, like Toots, a holy fool, because her pink nose and pink elbows and candid outcry and open indecent affections do convey to us a sense of innocence, because her pink nose and pink elbows and candid outcry and open indecent affections do convey to us a sense of innocence, helpless among human dragons, of Andromeda tied naked to a rock. Dickens had to make a character humorous before he could make it human. It was the only way he knew, and he ought to have always adhered to it. Whether he knew it or not, the only two really touching figures in Martin Chuzzlewit are the Mrs. Pecksniff. Of the things he tried to treat unsmilingly and grandly, we can all make game to our heart's content, but when once he has laughed at a thing, it is sacred forever. Dombey, however, means first and foremost the finale of the early Dickens. It is difficult to say exactly in what it is that we perceive that the old crudity ends here and does not reappear in David Copperfield or in any of the novels after it. But so it certainly is. In detached scenes, and in characters indeed, Dickens kept up his farcical note almost or quite to the end. But this is the last farce, this is the last work in which a farcical license is tacitly claimed, a farcical note struck to start with. And in a sense, his next novel may be called his first novel. But the growth of this great novel, David Copperfield, is a thing very interesting, but at the same time very dark, for it is a growth in the soul. We have seen that Dickens' mind was in stir of change, that he was dreaming of art and even of realism. Hugely delighted, as he invariably was with his own books, he was humble enough to be ambitious. He was even humble enough to be envious. In the matter of art, for instance, in the narrow sense of arrangement and proportion in fictitious things, he began to be conscious of his deficiency and even, in a stormy sort of way, ashamed of it. He tried to gain completeness even while raging at anyone who called him incomplete. And in this manner of artistic instruction, his ambition and his success, too, grew steadily up to the instant of his death. The end finds him attempting things that are at the opposite pole to the frank formlessness of Pickwick. His last book, The Mystery of Edwin Drood, depends entirely upon construction, even upon a centralized strategy. He staked everything upon a plot. He, who had been the weakest of plotters, weaker than Sim Tappertit, he essayed a detective story, he who could never keep a secret, and he has kept it to this day. A new Dickens was really being born when Dickens died. And as with art, so with reality. He wished to show that he could construct as well as anybody. He also wished to show that he could be as accurate as anybody. And in this connection, as in many others, we must recur constantly to the facts mentioned in connection with America and with his money matters. We must recur, I mean, to the central fact that his desires were extravagant in quantity, but not in quality, that his wishes were excessive, but not eccentric. It must never be forgotten that sanity was his ideal, even when he seemed almost insane. It was thus with his literary aspirations. He was brilliant, but he wished sincerely to be solid. Nobody out of an asylum could deny that he was a genius and a unique writer, but he did not wish to be a unique writer, but a universal writer. Much of the manufactured pathos or rhetoric against which his enemies quite rightly rail is really due to his desire to give all sides of life at once, to make his book a cosmos instead of a tale. He was sometimes really vulgar in his wish to be a literary Whitley, a universal provider. Thus it was that he felt about realism and truth to live. Nothing is easier than to defend Dickens as Dickens, but Dickens wished to be everybody else. Nothing is easier than to defend Dickens' world as a fairyland, of which he alone has the key, to defend him as one defends Maeterlinck or any other original writer. But Dickens was not content with being original. He had a wild wish to be true. He loved truth so much in the abstract that he sacrificed to the shadow of it in his own glory. He denied his own divine originality and pretended that he had plagiarized from life. He disowned his soul's children and said that he had picked them up in the street. And in this mixed and heated mood of anger and ambition, vanity and doubt, a new great design was born. He loved to be romantic, yet he desired to be real. How, if he wrote of a thing that was real and showed that it was romantic? He loved real life, but he also loved his own way. How, if he wrote of his own life, but wrote it in his own way? How, if he showed the carping critics who doubted the existence of his strange characters, his own yet stranger existence? How, if he forced these pedants and unbelievers to admit that Weller and Pecksniff, Crumless and Swiveller, whom they thought so improbably wild and wonderful, were less wild and wonderful than Charles Dickens? What if he ended the quarrels about whether his romances could occur by confessing that his romance had occurred? For some time past, probably during the greater part of his life, he had made notes for an autobiography. I have already quoted an admirable passage from these notes, a passage reproduced in David Copperfield with little more alteration than a change of proper names. The passage which describes Captain Porter and the debtor's petition in the Marshalsea. But he probably perceived at last what a less keen intelligence must ultimately have perceived, that if an autobiography is really to be honest, it must be turned into a work of fiction. If it is to really tell the truth, it must at all costs profess not to. No man dare say of himself over his own name how badly he has behaved. No man dare say of himself over his own name how well he has behaved. Moreover, of course, a touch of fiction is almost always essential to the real conveying of fact, because fact, as experienced, has a fragmentariness which is bewildering at first hand, and quite blinding at second hand. Facts have at least to be sorted into compartments, and the proper head and tail given back to each. The perfection and pointedness of art are sort of a substitute for the pungency of actuality. Without this selection and a completion, our life seems a tangle of unfinished tales, a heap of novels, all volume one. Dickens determined to make one complete novel of it. For though there are many other aspects of David Copperfield, this autobiographical aspect is, after all, the greatest. The point of the book is that, unlike all the other books of Dickens, it is concerned with quite common actualities, but it is concerned with them warmly and with warlike sympathies. Yet not only both realistic and romantic, it is realistic because it is romantic. It is a human nature described with human exaggeration. We all know the actual types in the book. They're not like the turgid and preternatural types elsewhere in Dickens. They're not purely poetic creations like Mr. Kenwigs or Mr. Bunsby. We all know that they exist. We all know the stiff-necked and humorous old-fashioned nurse, so conventional and yet so original, so dependent and yet so independent. We all know the intrusive stepfather, the abstract, strange male, coarse, handsome, sulky, successful. A breaker up of homes. We all know the erect and sardonic spinster, the spinster who is so mad in small things and so sane in great ones. We all know the cock of the school. We all know Steerforth, the creature whom the gods love and even the servants respect. We know his poor and artistic mother, so proud, so gratified, so desolate. We know the Rosa Dartle type, the lonely woman in whom affection itself has stagnated into a sort of poison. But while these are real characters, they are real characters lit up with the colors of youth and passion. They are real people romantically felt. That is to say, they are real people felt as real people feel them. They are exaggerated, like all Dickens figures, but they are not exaggerated as personalities are exaggerated by an artist. They are exaggerated as personalities are exaggerated by their own friends and enemies. The strong souls are seen through the glorious haze of the emotions that strong souls really create. We have Murdstone as he would be to a boy who hated him, and rightly, for a boy would hate him. We have Steerforth as he would be to a boy who adored him, and rightly, for a boy would adore him. It may be that if these persons had a mere terrestrial existence, they appeared to other eyes more insignificant. It may be that Murdstone, in common life, was only a heavy businessman with a human side, that David was too sulky to find. It may be that Steerforth was only an inch or two taller than David, and only a shade or two above him in the lower middle classes. But this does not make the book less true. In cataloguing the facts of life, the author must not omit that massive fact, illusion. When we say the book is true to life, we must stipulate that it is especially true to youth, even to boyhood. All the characters seem a little larger than they really were, for David is looking up at them, and the early pages of the book are in particular astonishingly vivid. Parts of it seem like fragments of our forgotten infancy. The dark house of childhood, the loneliness, the things half understood, the nurse with her inscrutable sulks and her more inscrutable tenderness, the sudden deportations to distant places, the seaside and its childish friendships. All this stirs in us when we read it, like something out of a previous existence. Above all, Dickens has excellently depicted the child enthroned in that humble circle which only in after years he perceives to have been humble. Modern and cultured persons, I believe, object to their children seeing kitchen company or being taught by a woman like Peggotty. But surely it is more important to be educated in a sense of human dignity and equality than in anything else in the world. And a child who has once had to respect a kind and capable woman of the lower classes will respect the lower classes forever. The true way to overcome the evil in class distinction is not to denounce them as revolutionists denounce them, but to ignore them as children ignore them. The early youth of David Copperfield is psychologically almost as good as his childhood. In one touch, especially, Dickens pierced the very core of the sensibilities of boyhood. It was when he made David more afraid of a manservant than of anybody or anything else. The lowering Murdstone, the awful Mrs. Steerforth, are not so alarming to him as Mr. Littimer, the unimpeachable gentleman's gentleman. This is exquisitely true to the masculine emotions, especially in their underdeveloped state. A youth of common courage does not fear anything violent, but he is in mortal fear of anything correct. This may or may not be the reason that so few female writers understand their male characters. But this fact remains, that the more sincere and passionate and even headlong a lad is, the more certain he is to be conventional. The bolder and freer he seems, the more the traditions of the college or the rules of the club will hold him with their gyves of gossamer, and the less afraid he is of his enemies, the more cravenly he will be afraid of his friends. Herein lies indeed the darkest period of our ethical doubt and chaos. The fear is that as mortals become less urgent, manners will become more so, and men who have forgotten the fear of God will retain the fear of Littimer. We shall merely sink into a much meaner bondage. For when you break the great laws, you do not get liberty. You do not even get anarchy. You get the small laws. The sting and strength of this piece of fiction, then, do by a rare accident lie in the circumstance that it was so largely founded on fact. David Copperfield is the great answer of a great romancer to the realists. David says, in effect, "What? You say the Dickens tales are too purple, really, to have happened? Why, this is what happened to me, and it seemed the most purple of all. You say that the Dickens heroes are too handsome and triumphant? Why, no prince or paladin Aristeo was ever so handsome and triumphant as the head boy seemed to me, walking before me in the sun. You say the Dickens villains are too black? Why, there was no ink in the devil's inkstand black enough for my own stepfather when I had to live in the same house with him. The facts are quite the other way to what you suppose. This life of grey studies and half-tones, the absence of which you regret in Dickens, is only life as it is looked at. This life of heroes and villains is life as it is lived. The life a man knows best is exactly the life he finds most full of fierce certainties and battles between good and ill, his own. Oh yes, the life we do not care about may easily be a psychological comedy. Other people's lives may easily be human documents. But a man's own life is always a melodrama." There are other effective things in David Copperfield. They are not all autobiographical. But they nearly all have this new note of quietude and reality. Micawber is gigantic, an immense assertion of the truth that the way to live is to exaggerate everything. But of him I shall have to speak more fully in another connection. Mrs. Micawber, artistically speaking, is even better. She is very nearly the best thing in Dickens. Nothing could be more absurd and at the same time more true than her clear, argumentative manner of speech as she sits smiling and expounding in the midst of ruin. What could be more lucid and logical and unanswerable than her statement of the prolegomena of the Medway problem, of which the first step must be to see the Medway, or of the coal trade, which required talent and capital. Talent Mr. Micawber has. Capital Mr. Micawber has not. It seems as if something should have come at last out of so clear and scientific arrangement of the ideas. Indeed, if, as has been suggested, we regard David Copperfield as an unconscious defense of the poetic view of life, we might regard Mrs. Micawber as an unconscious satire on the logical view of life. She sits as a monument of the hopelessness and helplessness of reason in the face of this romantic and unreasonable world. As I have taken Dombey and Son as the book before the transition, and David Copperfield as typical of the transition itself, I may perhaps take Bleak House as the book after the transition, and so complete the description. Bleak House has every characteristic of his new realistic culture. Dickens never now, as in his early books, revels in parts he likes and scamps the parts he does not, after the manner of Scott. He does not, as in previous tales, leave his heroes and heroines mere walking gentlemen and ladies, with nothing at all to do but walk. He expends upon them at least ingenuity. By the expedients, successful or not, of the self-revelation of Esther, or the humorous inconsistencies of Rick, he makes his younger figures, if not lovable, at least not readable. Everywhere we see this tighter and more careful grip. He does not, for instance, when he wishes to denounce a dark institution, sandwich it in as a mere episode in a rambling story of adventure, as the debtor's prison is embedded in the body of Pickwick, or the low Yorkshire school in the body of Nicholas Nickleby. He puts the Court of Chancery in the center of the stage, a somber and sinister temple, and groups round it in artistic relations decaying and frantic figures, its offspring and its satirists. An old dipsomaniac keeps a rag and bone shop type of futility and antiquity, and calls himself the Lord Chancellor. A little mad old maid hangs about the courts on a forgotten or imaginary lawsuit, and says, with perfect and pungent irony, "I am expecting a judgment shortly, on the day of judgment." Rick and Ada and Esther are not mere strollers who have strayed into the court of law. They are its children, its symbols, and its victims. The righteous indignation of the book is not at the red heat of anarchy, but at the white heat of art. Its anger is patient and plodding, like some historic revenge. Moreover, it slowly and carefully creates the real psychology of oppression, the endless formality, the endless unemotional urbanity, the endless hope deferred. These things make one feel the fact of injustice more than the madness of Nero. For it is not the activeness of tyranny that maddens, but its passiveness. We hate the deafness of the god more than his strength. Silence is the unbearable repartee. Again, we can see in this book strong traces of an increase in social experience. Dickens, as his fame carried him into more fashionable circles, began really to understand something of what is strong and what is weak in the English upper class. Sir Leicester Dedlock is far more effective condemnation of oligarchy than the ugly swagger of Sir Mulberry Hawk, because pride stands out more plainly in all its impotence and insolence as the one weakness of a good man than as one of the million weaknesses of a bad one. Dickens, like all young radicals, had imagined in his youth that aristocracy rested upon the hardiness of somebody. He found it, as we all do, that it rests upon the softness of everybody. It is very hard not to like Sir Leicester Dedlock, not to applaud his silly old speeches, so foolish, so manly, so genuinely English, so disastrous to England. It is true that the English people love a lord, but it is not true that they fear him. Rather, if anything, they pity him. There creeps into their love something of the feeling they have towards a baby or a black man. In their hearts they think it an admirable that Sir Leicester Dedlock should be able to speak at all. And so a system, which no iron laws and no bloody battles could possibly force upon a people, is preserved from generation to generation by pure, weak good nature. In Bleak House occurs the character of Harold Skimpole, the character whose alleged likeness to Leigh Hunt has laid Dickens open to so much disapproval. Unjust disapproval, I think, as far as fundamental morals are concerned. In method he was a little clamorous and clumsy, as indeed he was apt to be. But when he said that it was possible to combine a certain tone of conversation, taken from a particular man, with other characteristics which were not meant to be his, he surely said what all men who write stories know. A work of fiction often consists in combining a pair of whiskers seen in one street with a crime seen in another. He may quite possibly have really meant only to make Leigh Hunt's light philosophy the mask for a new kind of scamp, as a variant on the pious mask of Pecksniff or the candid mask of Bagstock. He may never once have had the unfriendly thought, suppose Hunt behaved like a rascal. He may have only had the fanciful thought, suppose a rascal behaved like Hunt. But there is good reason for mentioning Skimpole, especially in the character of Skimpole. Dickens displayed again a quality that was very admirable in him. I mean a disposition to see things sanely and to satirize even his own faults. He was commonly occupied in satirizing the Gadgrinds, the economists, the men of smiles and self-help. For him there was nothing poorer than their wealth, nothing more selfish than their self-denial. And against them he was in the habit of pitting the people of a more expansive habit, the happy swivellers and the Micawbers, who, if they were poor, were at least as rich as their last penny could make them. He loved that great Christian carelessness that seeks its meat from God. It was merely a kind of uncontrollable honesty that forced him into urging the other side. He could not disguise from himself or from the world that man who began by seeking his meat from his neighbor, without apprising his neighbor of the fact. He had shown how good irresponsibility could be. He could not stoop to hide how bad it could be. He created Skimpole, and Skimpole is the dark underside of Micawber. In attempting Skimpole, he attempted something with great and urgent meaning. He attempted it, I say. I do not assert that he carried it through. As has been remarked, he was never successful in describing psychological change. His characters are the same yesterday, today, and forever, and critics have complained very justly of the crude villainy of Skimpole's action in the matter of Joe and Mr. Bucket. Certainly Skimpole had no need to commit a clumsy treachery to win a clumsy bribe. He had only to call on Mr. Jarndyce. He had lost his honor too long to need to sell it. The effect is bad, but I repeat that the aim was great. Dickens wished, under the symbol of Skimpole, to point out a truth, which is, perhaps, the most terrible in moral psychology. I mean the fact that it is by no means easy to draw the line between light and heavy offense. He desired to show that there are no faults, however kindly, that we can afford to flatter or to let alone. He meant that perhaps Skimpole had once been as good a man as Swiveller. If flattered, or let alone, our kindliest fault can destroy our kindliest virtue. A thing may begin as very human weakness and end as very inhuman weakness. Skimpole means that the extremes of evil are much nearer than we think. A man may begin by being too generous to pay his debts and end by being too mean to pay his debts. For the vices are very strangely in league and encourage each other. A sober man may become a drunkard through being a coward. A brave man may become a coward through being a drunkard. That is the thing Dickens was darkly trying to convey in Skimpole, that a man might become a mountain of selfishness if he attended only to the Dickens virtues. There is nothing that can be neglected. There is no such thing, he meant, as a peccadillo. I have dwelt on this consciousness of his because, alas, it had a very sharp edge for himself. Even while he was permitting a fault, originally small, to make a comedy of Skimpole, a fault originally small was making a tragedy of Charles Dickens. For Dickens also had a bad quality, not intrinsically very terrible, which he allowed to wreck his life. He also had a small weakness that could sometimes become stronger than all his strengths. His selfishness was not, it need hardly be said, the selfishness of Gradgrind. He was particularly compassionate and liberal, nor was it in the least the selfishness of Skimpole. He was entirely self-dependent, industrious, and dignified. His selfishness was wholly a selfishness of the nerves. Whatever his whim or the temperature of the instant told him to do must be done. He was the type of man who would break a window if it would not open or give him air. And this weakness of his had, by the time of which we speak, led to a breach between himself and his wife, which he was too exasperated and excited to heal in time. Everything must be put right, and put right at once with him. If London bored him, he must go to the Continent at once. If the Continent bored him, he must come back to London at once. If the day was too noisy, the whole household must be quiet. If night was too quiet, the whole household must wake up. Above all, he had the supreme character of the domestic despot, that his good temper was, if possible, more despotic than his bad temper. When he was miserable, as he often was, poor fellow, they only had to listen to his railings. When he was happy, they had to listen to his novels. All this, which was mainly mere excitability, did not seem to amount to much. It did not in the least mean that he had ceased to be a clean-living and kind-hearted and quite honest man. But there was this evil about it, that he did not resist his little weakness at all. He pampered it, as Skimpole pampered his, and it separated him and his wife. A mere silly trick of temperament did everything that the blackest misconduct could have done. A random sensibility started about the shuffling of papers or the shutting of a window, ended by tearing two clean Christian people from each other, like a blast of bigamy or adultery. End of chapter 8. The Transition. G. K. Chesterton's Charles Dickens, Chapter 9, Later Life and Works. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, visit LibriVox.org. I have deliberately in this book mentioned only such facts in the life of Dickens as were, I will not say significant, for all facts must be significant, including the million facts that can never be mentioned by anybody, but such facts as illustrated my own immediate meaning. I have observed this method consistently and without shame, because I think that we can hardly make too evident a chasm between books which profess to be statements of all the ascertainable facts and books which, like this one, profess only to contain a particular opinion or a summary deducible from the facts. Books like Forster's exhaustive work and others exist, and are as accessible as St. Paul's Cathedral. We have them in common as we have the facts of the physical universe, and it seems highly desirable that the function of making an exhaustive catalogue, and that of making an individual generalization, should not be confused. No catalogue, of course, can contain all the facts even of 5 minutes. Every catalogue, however long and learned, must not only be a bold, but one may say an audacious selection. But if a great many facts are given, the reader gains a blurred belief that all the facts are being given. In a professedly personal judgment, it is therefore clearer and more honest to give only a few illustrative facts, leaving the other attainable facts to balance them. For thus it is made quite clear that the thing is a sketch, an affair of a few lines. It is as well, however, to make at this point a pause sufficient to indicate the main course of the later life of the novelist. And it's best to begin with the man himself, as he appeared in those last days of popularity and public distinction. Many are still alive who remember him in his after-dinner speeches, his lectures, and his many public activities. As I'm not one of these, I cannot correct my notions with that flash of the living features, without which a description may be subtly and entirely wrong. Once a man is dead, if it only be yesterday, the newcomer must piece him together from descriptions really as much at random as if he were describing Caesar or Henry II. Allowing, however, for this inevitable falsity, a figure vivid and a little fantastic does walk across the stage of Forster's life. Dickens was of a middle size, and his vivacity and relative physical insignificance probably gave rather the impression of small size, certainly of the absence of bulk. In early life he wore, even for that epoch, extravagant clusters of brown hair, and in later years a brown moustache and a fringe of brown beard, cut like a sort of broad and bushy imperial, sufficiently individual in shape to give him a faint air as of a foreigner. His face had a peculiar tint or quality which is hard to describe, even after one has contrived to imagine it. It was the quality which Mrs. Carlyle felt to be, as it were, metallic, and compared to clear steel. It was, I think, a sort of pale glitter and animation, very much alive and yet with something deathly about it, like a corpse galvanized by God. His face, if this was so, was curiously a counterpart of his character, but the essence of all Dickens' characters was that it was at once tremulous and yet hard and sharp, just as the bright blade of a sword is tremulous and yet hard and sharp. He vibrated at every touch, and yet he was indestructible. You could bend him, but you could not break him. Brown of hair and beard, somewhat pale of visage, especially in his later years of excitement and ill health, he had quite exceptionally bright and active eyes that were always darting about like brilliant birds to pick up all the tiny things of which he had made more, perhaps, than any novelist has done. For he was a sort of poetical Sherlock Holmes. The mouth behind the brown beard was large and mobile, like the mouth of an actor. Indeed, he was an actor, in many things too much of an actor. In his lectures, in later years, he could turn his strange face into any of the innumerable mad masks that were the blank inanity of Mrs. Rattle's servant, or swell, as if to twice its size, into the apocalyptic energy of Mr. Sergeant Buzfuz. The outline of his face itself, from his youth upwards, was cut quite delicate and decisive in repose, and in its own keen way may even have looked effeminate. The dress of the comfortable classes during the latter years of Dickens was compared with ours, somewhat slipshod and somewhat gaudy. It was the time of loose, peg-top trousers, of an almost Turkish oddity, of large ties, of loose, short jackets, and of loose, long whiskers. Yet even this expansive period, it must be confessed, considered Dickens a little too flashy, or, as some put it, too Frenchified in his dress. Such a man would wear velvet coats and wild waistcoats that were like incredible sunsets. He would wear those old white hats of an unnecessary and startling whiteness. He did not mind being seen in sensational dressing gowns. It is said he had his portrait painted in one of them. All of this is not meritorious, neither is it particularly discreditable. It is a characteristic only, but an important one. He was an absolutely independent and entirely self-respecting man, but he had none of that old, lusty, half-dignified English feeling upon which Thackeray was so sensitive. I mean the desire to be regarded as a private gentleman, which means at bottom the desire to be left alone. This again is not a merit. It is only one of the milder aspects of aristocracy. But meritorious or not, Dickens did not possess it. He had no objection to being stared at, if he were also admired. He did not exactly pose in the Oriental manner of Disraeli. His instincts were too clean for that. But he did pose somewhat in the French manner of some leaders like Mirabeau and Gambetta. Nor had he the dull desire to get on, which makes men die contented as inarticulate undersecretaries of state. He did not desire success so much as fame, the old human glory, the applause and wonder of the people. Such he was as he walked down the street in his Frenchified clothes, probably with a slight swagger. His private life consisted of one tragedy and 10,000 comedies. By one tragedy, I mean one real and rending moral tragedy, the failure of his marriage. He loved his children dearly, and more than one of them died. But in sorrows like these there is no violence, and above all no shame. The end of life is not tragic like the end of love. And by the 10,000 comedies, I mean the whole texture of his life, his letters, his conversation, which were one incessant carnival of insane and inspired improvisation. So far as he could prevent it, he never permitted a day of his life to be ordinary. There was always some prank, some impetuous proposal, some practical joke, some sudden hospitality, some sudden disappearance. It is related of him, I give one anecdote out of 100, that in his last visit to America, when he was already reeling, as it were, under the blow that was to be mortal, he remarked quite casually to his companions that a row of painted cottages looked exactly like the painted shops in a pantomime. No sooner had the suggestion passed his lips than he leapt to the nearest doorway, and in exact imitation of the clown of the Harlequinade, beat conscientiously with his fist, not on the door, for that would have burst the canvas scenery, of course, but on the side of the doorpost. Having done this, he lay down ceremoniously across the doorstep for the owner to fall over him if he should come rushing out. He then got up gravely and went on his way. His whole life was full of such unexpected energies, precisely like those of the pantomime clown. Dickens had indeed a great and fundamental affinity with the landscape, or rather housescape, of the Harlequinade. He liked high houses and sloping roofs and deep areas. But he would have been really happy if some good fairy of the eternal pantomime had given him the power of flying off the roofs and pitching harmlessly down the height of the houses and bounding out of the areas like his India rubber ball. The divine lunatic in Nicholas Nickleby comes nearest his dream. I really think Dickens would rather have been that one of his characters than any of the others. With what excitement he would have struggled down the chimney, with what ecstatic energy he would have hurled the cucumbers over the garden wall. His letters exhibit even more the same incessant creative force. His letters are as creative as any of his literary creation. His shortest postcard is often as good as his ablest novel. Each one of them is spontaneous, each one of them is different. He varies even the form and shape of the letter as far as possible. Now it is in absurd French, now it is from one of his characters, now it is an advertisement for himself as a stray dog. All of them are very funny. They are not only very funny, but they are quite as funny as his finished and published work. This is the ultimately amazing thing about Dickens, the amount there is of him. He wrote, at the very least, 16 thick, important books packed full of original creation, and if you had burnt them all, he could have written 16 more, as a man writes idle letters to a friend. In connection with this exuberant part of his nature, There is another thing to be noted, if we are to make a personal picture of him. Many modern people, chiefly women, have been heard to object to the Bacchic element in the books of Dickens, that celebration of social drinking as a supreme symbol of social living, which those books share with almost all the great literature of mankind, including the New Testament. Undoubtedly, there is an abnormal amount of drinking in a page of Dickens, just as there is an abnormal amount of fighting, say, in a page of Dumas. If you reckon up the beers and brandies of Mr. Bob Sawyer with the care of an arithmetician and the deductions of a pathologist, they rise alarmingly like a rising tide at sea. Dickens did defend drink clamorously, praised it with passion, and described whole orgies of it with enormous gusto. Yet it is wonderfully typical of his prompt and impatient nature that he himself drank comparatively little. He was the type of man who could be so eager in praising the cup that he left the cup untasted. It was a part of his activity and feverish temperament that he did not drink wine very much, but it was a part of his humane philosophy, of his religion, that he did not drink wine. To healthy European philosophy, wine is a symbol. To European religion, it is a sacrament. Dickens approved it because it was a great human institution, one of the rites of civilization, and this it certainly is. The teetotaler, who stands outside it, may have perfectly clear ethical reasons of his own, as a man may have who stands outside education or nationality, who refuses to go to a university or to serve an army. But he is neglecting one of the great social things that man has added to nature. The teetotaler has chosen a most unfortunate phrase for the drunkard when he says that the drunkard is making a beast of himself. The man who drinks ordinarily makes nothing but an ordinary man of himself. The man who drinks excessively makes a devil of himself. But nothing connected with a human and artistic thing like wine can bring one nearer to the brute life of nature. The only man who is, in the exact and literal sense of the words, making a beast of himself, is the teetotaler. Tone of Dickens toward religion, though like that of most of his contemporaries, philosophically disturbed and rather historically ignorant, had an element that was very characteristic of himself. He had all the prejudices of his time. He had, for instance, that dislike of defined dogma, which really means a preference for unexamined dogmas. He had the usual vague notion that the whole of our human past was packed with nothing but insane Tories. He had, in a word, all the old radical ignorances which went along with the old radical acuteness and courage and public spirit. But this spirit tended, in almost all the others who held it, to a specific dislike of the Church of England and a disposition to set the other sects against it as truer types of inquiry or of individualism. Dickens had a definite tenderness for the Church of England. He might even call it a weakness for the Church of England, but he had it. Something in those placid services, something in that reticent and humane liturgy pleased him against all tendencies of his time, pleased him in the best part of himself, his virile love of charity and peace. Once, in a puff of anger at the Church's political stupidity, which is indeed profound, he left it for a week or two and went to a Unitarian chapel. In a week or two he came back. This curious and sentimental hold of the English Church upon him increased with years. In the book he was at work on when he died, he describes the minor canon, humble, chivalrous, tender-hearted, answering with indignant simplicity to the froth and platform righteousness of the sectarian philanthropist. He upholds Canon Crisparkle and satirizes Mr. Honeythunder. Almost every one of the other radicals, his friends, would have upheld Mr. Honeythunder and satirized Canon Crisparkle. I have mentioned this matter for a special reason. It brings us back to that apparent contradiction or dualism in Dickens, to which, in one connection or another, I have often adverted, and which, in one shape or another, constitutes the whole crux of his character. I mean the union of a general wildness, approaching lunacy, with a sort of secret moderation almost amounting to mediocrity. Dickens was more or less the man I have described. Sensitive, theatrical, amazing, a bit of a dandy, a bit of a buffoon. Nor are such characteristics, whether weak or wild, entirely accidents or externals. He had some false theatrical tendencies integral in his nature. For instance, he had one most unfortunate habit, a habit that often put him in the wrong, even when he happened to be in the right. He had an incurable habit of explaining himself. This reduced his admirers to the mental condition of the authentic but hitherto uncelebrated little girl who said to her mother, "I think I should understand if only you wouldn't explain." Dickens always would explain. It was a part of that instinctive publicity of his which made him at once a splendid democrat and a little too much of an actor. He carried it to the craziest lengths. He actually printed in Household Words an apology for his own action in the matter of his marriage. That incident alone is enough to suggest that his external offers and proposals were sometimes like screams heard from Bedlam. Yet it remains true that he had in him a central part that was pleased only by the most decent and most reposeful rites, by things of which the Anglican prayer book is a very typical. It is certainly true that he was often extravagant. It is most certainly equally true that he detested and despised extravagance. The best explanation can be found in his literary genius. His literary genius consisted in a contradictory capacity at once to entertain and to deride very ridiculous ideas. If he is a buffoon, he is laughing at buffoonery. His books were in some ways the wildest on the face of the world. Rabelais did not introduce into Paphlagonia or the Kingdom of the Coquerigues satiric figures more frantic and misshapen than Dickens made to walk about the Strand and the Lincoln's Inn. But for all that, you come in the core of him, on a sudden quietude and good sense. Such, I think, was the core of Rabelais. Such were all the far-stretching and violent satirists. This is the point essential to Dickens, though very little comprehended in our current tone of thought. Dickens was an immoderate jester, but a moderate thinker. He was an immoderate jester because he was a moderate thinker. What we moderns call the wildness of his imagination was actually created by what we moderns call the tameness of his thought. I mean that he felt the full insanity of all extreme tendencies, because he was himself so sane. He felt eccentricities, because he was in the center. We're always, in these days, asking our violent prophets to write violent satires. But violent prophets can never possibly write violent satires. In order to write satires like that of Rabelais, satire that juggles with the stars and kicks the world about like a football, it is necessary to be one self-temperate and even mild. A modern man like Nietzsche, a modern man like Gorky, a modern man like D'Annunzio, could not possibly write real and riotous satire. They are themselves too much on the borderlands. They could not be a success as caricaturists, for they are already a great success as caricatures. I have mentioned his religious preference merely as an instance of this interior moderation. To say, as some have done, that he attacked nonconformity is quite a false way of putting it. It is clean across the whole trend of the man and his time to suppose that he could have felt bitterness against any theological body as a theological body. But anything like religious extravagance, whether Protestant or Catholic, moved him to an extravagance of satire, and he flung himself into the drunken energy of Stiggins. He piled up to the stars the verbose flights of stairs of Mr. Chadband, exactly because his own conception of religion was the quiet and impersonal morning prayer. It is typical of him that he had a peculiar hatred for speeches at the graveside. An even clearer case of what I mean can be found in his political attitude. He seemed to some an almost anarchic satirist. He made equal fun of the system which reformers made war on, and of the instruments on which the reformers relied. He made no secret of his feelings that the average English premier was an accidental ass. In two superb sentences, he summed up and swept away the whole British constitution. England for the last week has been in an awful state. Lord Coodle would go out, Sir Thomas Doodle wouldn't come in, and there being no people in England to speak of except Coodle and Doodle, the country has been without a government. He lumped all cabinets and all government offices together and made the same game of them all. He created his most staggering humbugs, his most adorable and incredible idiots, and set them on the highest thrones of our national system. To many moderate and progressive people, such a satirist seemed to be insulting heaven and earth, ready to wreck society for some mad alternative, prepared to pull down St. Paul's and on its ruins erect a gory guillotine. Yet, as a matter of fact, this apparent wildness of his came from his being, if anything, a very moderate politician. It came not at all from fanaticism, but from a rather rational detachment. He had the sense to see that the British Constitution was not democracy, but the British Constitution. It was an artificial system, like any other, good in some ways, bad in others. His satire of it sounded wild to those who worshipped it, but his satire of it arose not from his having any wild enthusiasm against it, but simply from his not having, like everyone else, a wild enthusiasm for it. Alone, as far as I know, among all the great Englishmen of that age, he realized the thing that Frenchmen and Irishmen understand. I mean the fact that popular government is one thing and representative government is another. He realized that representative government has many minor disadvantages, one of them being that it is never representative. He speaks of his hope to have made every man in England feel something of the contempt for the House of Commons that I have. He says also these two things, both of which are wonderfully penetrating as coming from a good radical in 1855, but they contain a perfect statement of the peril in which we now stand, and which may, if it please God, sting us into avoiding the long vista at the end of which one sees so closely the dignity and the decay of Venice. I am hourly strengthened, he says, in my old belief that our political aristocracy and our tuft hunting are the death of England. In all this business I don't see a gleam of hope. As to the populist spirit, it has come to be so entirely separated from the Parliament and the Government, and so perfectly apathetic about them both, that I seriously think it is a most portentous sign. And he says also this, I really am serious in thinking, and I have given as painful consideration to the subject as a man with children to live and suffer after him can possibly give it, that representative government is become altogether a failure with us, that the English gentilities and subserviences render the people more unfit for it, and the whole thing has broken down since the great 17th century time and has no hope in it. These are the words of a wise and perhaps melancholy man, but certainly not of an unduly excited one. It is worth noting, for instance, how much more directly Dickens goes to the point than Carlyle did, who noted many of the same evils. But Carlyle fancied that our modern English government was wordy and long-winded because it was democratic government. Dickens saw what is certainly the fact, that it is wordy and long-winded, because it is an aristocratic government, the two most pleasant aristocratic qualities being a love of literature and an unconsciousness of time. But all this amounts to the same conclusion of the matter. Frantic figures like Stiggins and Chadbrand were created out of the quietude of his religious preference. Wild creations like the Barnacles and the Bounderbys were produced in a kind of ecstasy of ordinary, of the obvious in political justice. His monsters were made out of his level and his moderation, as the old monsters were made out of the sea. Such was the man of genius we must try to imagine, violently emotional, yet with a good judgment. pugnacious, but only when he thought himself oppressed, prone to think himself oppressed, yet not cynical about human motives. He was a man remarkably hard to understand or to reanimate. He almost always had reasons for his action. His error was that he always expounded them. Sometimes his nerve snapped, and then he was mad. Unless it did so, he was quite unusually sane. Such a rough sketch, at least, must suffice us in order to summarize his later years. Those years were occupied, of course, in two main additions to his previous activities. The first was the series of public readings and lectures, which he now began to give systematically. The second was his successive editorship of Household Words, and of All the Year Round. He was of a type that enjoys every new function and opportunity. He had been so many things in his life, a reporter, an actor, a conjurer, a poet. As he had enjoyed them all, so he enjoyed being a lecturer and enjoyed being an editor. It is certain that his audiences, who sometimes stacked themselves so thick that they lay flat on the platform all round him, enjoyed his being a lecturer. It is not so certain that the sub-editors enjoyed his being an editor. But in both connections, the main matter of importance is the effect on the permanent work of Dickens himself. The readings were important for this reason, that they fixed, as if by some public and pontifical pronouncement, what was Dickens' interpretation of Dickens' work. Such a knowledge is mere tradition, but it is very forcible. My own family has handed on to me, and I shall probably hand on to the next generation, a definite memory of how Dickens made his face suddenly like the face of an idiot in impersonating Mrs. Raddle's servant, Betsy. This does serve one of the permanent purposes of tradition. It does make a little more difficult for any ingenious person to prove that Betsy was meant to be a brilliant satire on the over-cultivation of intellect. As for his relation to his two magazines, it is chiefly important, first for the admirable things which he wrote, for the magazines themselves. One cannot forbear to mention the intimate monologue of the waiter in Somebody's Luggage, and secondly, for the fact that in his capacity of editor, he made one valuable discovery. He discovered Wilkie Collins. Wilkie Collins was the one man of unmistakable genius who has a certain affinity with Dickens, an affinity in this respect, that they both combine in a curious way a modern and a cockney and even commonplace opinion about things with huge elemental sympathy with strange oracles and spirits and old night. There were no two men in mid-Victorian England with their top hats and umbrellas more typical of its rationality and dull reform, and there were no two men who could touch them in a ghost story. No two men would have had more contempt for superstitions, and no two men could so create the superstitious thrill. Indeed, our modern mystics make a mistake when they wear long hair or loose ties to attract the spirits. The elves and the old gods, when they revisit the earth, really go straight for a dull top hat, for it means simplicity, which the gods love. Meanwhile, his books, appearing from time to time, while as brilliant as ever, bore witness to that increasing tendency to a more careful and responsible treatment which we have remarked in the transition which culminated in Bleak House. His next important book, Hard Times, strikes an almost unexpected note of severity. The characters are indeed exaggerated, but they are bitterly and deliberately exaggerated. They are not exaggerated with the old unconscious high spirits of Nicholas Nickleby or Martin Chuzzlewit. Dickens exaggerates Bounderby because he really hates him. He exaggerated Pecksniff because he really loved him. Hard Times is not one of the greatest books of Dickens, but it is perhaps in a sense one of the greatest monuments. It stamps and records the reality of Dickens' emotions on a great many things that were then considered unphilosophical grumblings, but which since have swelled into the immense phenomena of the socialist philosophy. To call Dickens a socialist is a wild exaggeration, but the truth and peculiarity of his position might be expressed thus: that even when everybody thought that liberalism meant individualism, he was emphatically a liberal and emphatically not an individualist. Or the truth might be better still stated in this manner: that he saw that there was a secret thing called humanity to which both extreme socialism and extreme individualism were profoundly and inexpressibly indifferent, and that this permanent and presiding humanity was the thing he happened to understand. He knew that individualism is nothing and non-individualism is nothing but the keeping of the commandment of man. He felt, as a novelist should, that the question is too much discussed as to whether man is in favor of this or that scientific philosophy, that there is another question, whether the scientific philosophy is in favor of man. That is why such books as Hard Times will remain always a part of the power and tradition of Dickens. He saw that economic systems are not things like the stars, but things like the lampposts, manifestations of the human mind, and things to be judged by the human heart. Thenceforward, until the end, his books grow consistently graver and, as it were, more responsible. He improves as an artist, if not always as a creator. Little Dorrit, published in 1857, is at once in some ways so much more subtle and in every way so much more sad than the rest of his work that it bores Dickensians and especially pleases George Gissing. It is the only one of the Dickens tales which could please Gissing, and not by its genius, but also by its atmosphere. There is something a little modern and a little sad, something also out of tune with the main trend of Dickens' moral feeling, about the description of the character of Dorrit as actually and finally weakened by his wasting experiences, as not lifting any cry above the conquered years. It is but a faint fleck of shadow, but the illimitable white light of human hopefulness of which I spoke at the beginning is ebbing away. The work of the revolution is growing weaker everywhere, and the night of necessitarianism cometh when no man can work. For the first time in a book by Dickens, perhaps, we really do feel that the hero is 45. Clennam is certainly very much older than Mr. Pickwick. This was, indeed, only a fugitive gray cloud. He went on to breezier operations, but whatever they were, they still had the note of the latter days. They have a more cautious craftsmanship. They have a more mellow and more mixed human sentiment. Shadows fell upon his page from the other and sadder figures out of the Victorian decline. A good instance of this is his next book, The Tale of Two Cities. In dignity and eloquence, it almost stands alone among the books by Dickens. But it also stands alone among his books in this respect, that it is not entirely by Dickens. It owes its inspiration, avowedly, to the passionate and cloudy pages of Carlyle's French Revolution, and there is something quite essentially inconsistent between Carlyle's disturbed and half-skeptical transcendentalism and the original school and spirit to which Dickens belonged. The lucid and laughing decisiveness of the old, convinced and contented radicalism. Hence the genius of Dickens cannot save him, just as the great genius of Carlyle could not save him from making a picture of the French Revolution, which was delicately and yet deeply erroneous. Both tend too much to represent it as a mere elemental outbreaking of hunger or vengeance. They do not see enough that it was a war for intellectual principles, even for intellectual platitudes. We, the modern English, cannot easily understand the French Revolution because we cannot easily understand the ideas of bloody battle for pure common sense. We cannot understand common sense in arms and conquering. In modern England, common sense appears to mean putting up with existing conditions. For us, a practical politician really means a man who can be thoroughly trusted to do nothing at all. That is where his practicality comes in. The French feeling, the feeling at the back of the revolution, was that the more sensible a man was, the more you must look out for slaughter. In all the imitators of Carlyle, including Dickens, there is an obscure sentiment that the thing for which the Frenchman died must have been something new and queer, a paradox, a strange idolatry. But when such blood ran in the streets, it was for the sake of a truism. When those cities were shaken to their foundation, they were shaken to their foundations by a truism. I have mentioned this historical matter because it illustrates these later and more mingled influences, which at once improve and, as it were, perplex the later work of Dickens. For Dickens had in his original mental composition capacities for understanding this cheery and sensible element in the French Revolution far better than Carlyle. The French Revolution was, among other things, French, and so, as far as that goes, one could never have a precise counterpart in so jolly and autochthonous an Englishman as Charles Dickens. But there was a great deal of the actual and unbroken tradition of the Revolution itself in his early radical indictments, in his denunciation of the Fleet Prison. There was a great deal of the capture of the Bastille. There was, above all, a certain reasonable impatience which was the essence of the old Republican, and which is quite unknown to the revolutionist in modern Europe. The old Radical did not feel exactly that he was in revolt. He felt, if anything, that a number of idiotic institutions had revolted against reason and against him. Dickens, I say, had the revolutionary idea, though an English form of it, by clear and conscious inheritance. Carlyle had to rediscover the revolution by a violence of genius and vision. If Dickens, then, took from Carlyle, as he said he did, his image of the Revolution, it does certainly mean that he had forgotten something of his own youth and come under the more complex influences of the end of the 19th century. His old hilarious and sentimental view of human nature seems for a moment dimmed in Little Dorrit. His old political simplicity has been slightly disturbed by Carlyle. I repeat that this graver note is varied, but it remains a graver note. We see it struck, I think, with particular and remarkable success in Great Expectations. This fine story is told with a consistency and quietude of individuality which is rare in Dickens. But so far had he traveled along the road of a heavier reality that he even intended to give the tale an unhappy ending, making Pip lose Estella forever. And he was only dissuaded from it by the robust romanticism of Bulwer Lytton. The best part of the tale, the account of the vacillations of the hero between the humble life to which he owes everything and the gorgeous life from which he expects something, touches a very true and somewhat tragic part of morals. For the great paradox of morality, the paradox to which only the religions have given an adequate expression, is that the very vilest kind of fault is exactly the most easy kind. We read in books and ballads about the wild fellow who might kill a man or smoke opium, but who would never stoop to lying or cowardice or to anything mean. But for actual human beings, opium and slaughter have only occasional charm. The permanent human temptation is the temptation to be mean. The one standing probability is the probability of becoming a cowardly hypocrite. The circle of the traitors is the lowest of the abyss, and it is also the easiest to fall into. That is one of the ringing realities of the Bible, that it does not make its great men commit grand sins. It makes its great men, such as David and St. Peter, commit small sins and behave like sneaks. Dickens has dealt with this easy descent of desertion, this silent treason, with remarkable accuracy in the account of the indecisions of Pip. It contains a good suggestion of that weak romance which is at the root of all snobbishness, that the mystery which belongs to patrician life excites us more than the open, even the indecent virtues of the humble. Pip is keener about Miss Havisham, who may mean well by him, than about Joe Gargery, who evidently does. All this is very strong and wholesome, but it is still a little stern. Our Mutual Friend, 1864, brings us back a little into his merrier and more normal manner. Some of the satire, such as that upon Veneering's election, is in the best of his old style, so airy and fanciful, yet hitting so suddenly and so hard. But even here we find the fuller and more serious treatment of psychology, notably in the two facts that he creates a really human villain, Bradley Headstone, and also one whom we might call a really human hero, Eugene, if it were not that he is much too human to be called a hero at all. It has been said, invariably by cads, that Dickens never described the gentleman. It is like saying that he never described a zebra. The gentleman is a very rare animal among human creatures, and to people like Dickens, interested in all humanity, not a supremely important one. But in Eugene Wayburn, he does, whether he consciously or not, turn that accusation with a vengeance, for he not only describes a gentleman, but describes the inner weaknesses and peril that belong to a gentleman, the devil that is always rending the entrails of an idle and agreeable man. In Eugene's purposeless pursuit of Lizzie Hexham, in his yet more purposeless torturing of Bradley Headstone, the author has marvelously realized that singularly empty obstinacy that drives the whims and pleasures of a leisured class. He sees that there is nothing that such a man more stubbornly adheres to than the thing that he does not particularly want to do. We are still in serious psychology. His last book represents yet another new departure, dividing him from the chaotic Dickens of days long before. His last book is not merely an attempt to improve his power of construction in a story. It is an attempt to rely entirely on that power of construction. It not only has a plot, it is a plot. The Mystery of Edwin Drood, 1870, was in such a sense, perhaps, the most ambitious book that Dickens ever attempted. It is, as everyone knows, a detective story, and certainly a very successful one, as it is attested by the tumult of discussion as to its proper solution. In this, quite apart from its unfinished state, it stands, I think, alone among the author's works. Elsewhere, if he introduced a mystery, he seldom took the trouble to make it very mysterious. Bleak House is finished, but if it were only half finished, I think anyone would guess that Lady Dedlock and Nemo had sinned in the past. Edwin Drood is not finished, for in the very middle of it, Dickens died. He had altogether overstrained himself in a last lecturing tour in America. He was a man in whom any serious malady would naturally make very rapid strides, for he had the temper of an irrational invalid. I have said before that there was in his curious character something that was feminine. Certainly there was nothing more entirely feminine than this, that he worked because he was tired. Fatigue bred in him a false and feverish industry, and his case increased like the case of a man who drinks to cure the effects of drink. He died in 1870, and the whole nation mourned him, as no public man has ever been mourned, for prime ministers and princes were private persons compared with Dickens. He had been a great popular king, like a king of some more primal age, whom his people could come and see, giving judgment under an oak tree. He had, in essence, held great audiences of millions, and made proclamations to more than one of the nations of the earth. His obvious omnipresence in every part of public life was like the omnipresence of the sovereign. His secret omnipresence in every house and hut of private life was more like the omnipresence of a deity. Compared with that popular leadership, all the fusses of the last 40 years are diversions in idleness. Compared with such a case as his, it may be said that we play with our politicians and manage to endure our authors. We shall never have again such a popularity until we have again a people. He left behind him this almost somber fragment, The Mystery of Edwin Drood. As one turns it over, the tragic element of its truncation mingles somewhat with an element of tragedy in the thing itself. The passionate and predestined landless or the half-maniacal Jasper carving devils out of his own heart. The workmanship of it is very fine. The right hand has not only lost, but is still gaining its cunning. But as we turn the now enigmatic pages, the thought creeps into us again, which I have suggested earlier, and which is never far off the mind of a true lover of Dickens. Had he lost or gained by the growth of this technique and probability in his later work? His later characters were more like men, but were not his earlier characters more like immortals? He has become able to perform a social scene so that it is possible at any rate. But where is that Dickens who once performed the impossible? Where is that young poet who created such majors and architects as nature will never dare to create? Dickens learned to describe daily life as Thackeray and Jane Austen could describe it. But Thackeray could not have thought such a thought as Crummles, and it is painful to think of Miss Austen attempting to imagine Mantalini. After all, we feel there are many able novelists, but there is only one Dickens, and whither has he fled? He was alive to the end, and in this last dark and secretive story of Edwin Drood, he makes one splendid and staggering appearance, like a magician saying farewell to mankind. In the center of this otherwise reasonable and rather melancholy book, this gray story of a good clergyman and the quiet Cloisterham towers, Dickens has calmly inserted one entirely delightful and entirely insane passage. I mean the frantic and inconceivable epithet of Mrs. Sapsea, that which describes her as the reverential wife of Thomas Sapsea, speaks of her consistency in looking up to him, and ends with the words spaced out so admirably on the tombstone. Stranger, pause, and ask thyself this question. Canst thou do likewise? If not, with a blush, retire. Not the wildest tale in Pickwick contains such an impossibility as that. Dickens dare scarcely have introduced it, even as one of Jingle's lies. In no human churchyard will you find that invaluable tombstone. Indeed, you could scarcely find it in any world where there are churchyards. You could scarcely have such immortal folly as that in a world where there is also death. Mr. Sapsea is one of the golden things stored up for us in a better world. Yes, there were many other Dickenses, a clever Dickens, an industrious Dickens, a public-spirited Dickens. But this was the great one. This last outbreak of insane humor reminds us wherein lay his power and his supremacy. The praise of such beatific buffoonery should be the final praise, the ultimate word in his honor. The wild epithet of Mrs. Sapsea should be the serious epithet of Dickens. End of Chapter 9. Later Life and Works.
Prime Day is coming July 16th and 17th, with epic deals exclusively for Prime members. You'll feel like you just won an award.
Oh, wow, I didn't even prepare a speech. I'd like to thank my family for always needing stuff. Also Sam, my delivery guy, for bringing all my awesome deals so fast. You're the man, Sam!
Shop deals on electronics, home, and more this Prime Day, July 16th and 17th.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at synovus.com.